Best I can do is a blood sample, he said. But I think you'll hand it over to the Kaminoans, Boba, or your doctors will. And we really wouldn't be very happy about that. Not at all.
We?
Myrta felt she was getting on better with Jang. She'd used her advantage as the harmless, tragic granddaughter.
How many of you are there left?
You don't need to know that. Look, I've got grandchildren too, Boba. And great-grandchildren. I've got a family on Mandalore. So I care what happens when you're gone. Much as it pains me, your Buad here is right. Mandalore needs you for the foreseeable future.
Fett made a very good job of looking bored.
So I get the blood if I keep the Kaminoans out of it.
Not that simple, said Jang.
It never is.
You give me blood and tissue samples and I'll get something made up for you, if I can.
And I'm supposed to trust you?
As much as I'm supposed to trust you. And don't even think about taking a sample from me the hard way.
Okay.
Fett's jaw twitched again.
Thank you.
He made it sound like a foreign language, awkward and unfamiliar in his mouth. Myrta resisted the urge to react.
Well done, Babu Ear. Was that so hard?
Jang wasn't done, though.
There's a condition, of course.
There always is.
Fett crossed his arms.
What?
Get your ships back to Mandalore. Listen to Kadika's advice and build a strong, united, stable state. Prove you're half the man that Jester Mareel and Fen Shaisa were. All you want to do is emulate your old man, Boba. But you're too scared to exceed him, aren't you? You can't be better than Jango. That would never do.
Myrta flinched. Mentioning his father without due reverence seemed to be the one thing that really got Fett riled. His voice didn't change, but he unfolded his arms with slow care.
My father finally destroyed the Death Watch. That's his legacy to Mandalore.
Sectarian feud, irrelevant to most Mandoade's lives. Now, are you gonna give me a sample?
What kind of scientist do you have access to that I haven't?
Some things, Jang said softly, can't be bought. I have my resources, believe me. Got a medpack with a sharp in it?
Yes.
Draw some blood, then.
I'll do it, said Myrta.
Myrta didn't expect him to flinch when she finally found a vein, and he didn't. The few moments while she applied pressure to the blood vessel with her thumb to stop the bleeding afterward were the longest of her life. Because he wouldn't meet her eyes, and it reminded her that she could touch him and still not reach him. Jang held the vial of red-black blood up to the light and admired it.
That'll do nicely.
GAG Headquarters, Coruscant.
Captain Hilo Gurdon smiled and beckoned Ben into a dark office. Somehow the two elements combined into Ben's least favorite way to spend an afternoon.
Behold,
he said, and Ben's eyes adjusted to the low light. There were no windows. The only illumination was from banks of holoscreens and monitors. Ben realized there were GAG troopers sitting at consoles, with that glaze of defocused concentration that looked like blank boredom.
The eyes and ears of the guard. Welcome to the monitoring center.
The ultimate in scrutiny. Gurdon steered Ben by his shoulder, taking him to an alcove away from the active consoles.
This is where we keep an eye on senators and other social misfits, for their own good.
Whose calls do you tap?
Ben felt uneasy about it.
I bet it's not even exciting.
All government staff are specialists of probable and proven scumbags and politicians, said Gurdon. And given the number of senators and the volume of hot air they emit, we get automated voice recognition systems to do it, or we'd be here for the next 1,000 years. If the droid picks up any keywords of interest, it tags the conversation and alerts us. Then we have to sit and actually listen to it.
One of the troopers, Zverk, was ladling sweetener into a cup of calf. He sipped it gingerly, looking slightly comical with an audio buffer lead dangling from his ear.
I joined the army to see the galaxy, he whispered. But all I got was 8-hour watches of listening to weird politicians making appointments to...
Ben's 14, Gurdon said.
Well, if you want him to do monitoring, he's gonna hear stuff that'll make his hair curl, sir.
Ben had never considered what tapping comlinks of suspects and people in sensitive posts actually entailed.
I won't faint, he said. And if I'm old enough to get shot at, I'm old enough to hear... stuff.
Can't argue with that logic.
Gurdon sat him down at a console and gave him an earpiece.
Okay. The screen here shows you the sound files the droids lined up as worth listening to, as well as holocam footage. You just work through it and make notes if anything seems worth following up. You're looking for anyone who might be contacting senators and seems a bit odd. Any conversations about senators or government staff? Look, you're a Jedi. You've probably got a sixth sense about this stuff, just like you have about hidden explosives.
So do neck battle dogs, said Zverk. But Lieutenant Skywalker smells better, and he can do tricks.
Ben settled in his seat to begin checking recordings. The monitoring center smelled strongly of calf. Ben felt in need of some, too, after a few hours, and he lost himself in a conversation between two government staff about the regular route that a certain senator took from the Senate to her apartment. But he was jerked out of his concentration by a rustle of fabric and quiet, intense activity at another console. Zverk had summoned Gurdon, and they both looked grim. Ben paused to listen.
You sure?
Gurdon asked.
Run a voice profile if you don't believe me, Zverk said. That's the Corellian PM.
There were 10 people in the room, and they'd all stopped to listen. Gedgen's soothingly persuasive voice, with its faint accent, was telling someone that there was no point doing this through the usual channels, because nobody else was in a negotiating mood.
You and I know that this could be solved by the removal of a few hotheads. Some of our military needs slapping down, and so do some of yours. I'd call an immediate ceasefire if I could be assured of a few things.
Such as?
Said the unmistakable voice of Chief of State Omos. They were tapping the Chief of State's secure comm line. Ben wasn't sure they had authorization to do that.
We'll agree that Corellia pools its military assets with the GA, as long as we have an opt-out clause that says we have the right to withdraw it if our own needs are more urgent. Niathal has to go. Jason Solo has to go. Once that's out of the way, we're back to normal, and you've got what you want.
Center point.
Well, we're having problems repairing it anyway.
Center point has to be made inoperative.
A pause. Too brief even for most people to notice, but Ben did.
It already is. But if you want a multiplanetary force or observers there, fine.
What about the Bothans and the other planets fighting their own wars?
I can bring the Kaminoans into line. And the Bothans, well, once we're all back in the GA, then Bothawee's got to toe the line. The little people, if the fighting gets out of hand, will commit troops to put a stop to that.
The Senate won't agree to this.
Take Niathal and Solo out of the equation first, and they'll calm down. What's left of the Senate, anyway?
Take out? They won't go quietly. They might split the Senate. Gassil's totally in their camp, and he's got weight.
Well, there's take out, and take out.
Omos swallowed, but didn't respond. Gedgen filled the silence.
You know we have a job to do before this draws in the whole galaxy.
Okay, okay.
We need to meet. Can you get to Volptr?
Long pause.
I'll find an excuse. Send me the details.
Gurdon stood looking at the screen, as if he could get some sense out of it if he stared long enough. Zverk sat with his chin propped on his hand, gazing up at the captain for orders.
Get a transcription of that to Colonel Solo right away.
Supreme Commander's Office, Senate Building, Coruscant.
G
Jason read the transcript a third time and laid his datapad down on Niathal's desk. She had a hologram of Mon Cal on the wall behind her, all shimmering blue ocean and sinuous buildings emerging from the waves in floating cities. He wondered if she was homesick. Right now, she was fresh back from a battle that hadn't gone as planned, and impatient to see Cal Omos about it. Nothing like a united front in wartime. He leaned back in the chair, fingers meshed behind his head. So we're not the flavor of the month. Our glorious leader didn't exactly spring to our defense. Niathal's white uniform didn't look crumpled, even though she'd just disembarked from a warship fresh from a battle.
Smacks of ingratitude, I'd say.
She wasn't one for humor. You realize that when Gedgen says someone has to go, he doesn't mean a golden handshake and a framed certificate thanking them for loyal service.
Spit it out, Jason.
He was behind Sal Solo's premature death. She narrowed her eyes, heavy with sarcasm.
I'm shocked, I tell you. Shocked.
And the attempt on the Hapen Queen Mother's life. We're next. Niathal's nostrils closed tight for a second. It was a giveaway with Mon Cal's. A little tell that said they were surprised, and not in a good way.
He wouldn't be stupid enough to try that.
Right now, I don't know what he'd try.
Omos isn't a fool. He must have a good idea of what he's dealing with.
What do you think he's up to?
All he wants to do is hold the Alliance together. He always thinks a few raps over the knuckles can bring naughty governments into line. Well, it didn't work with Corellia, and now he's watching the Alliance shrink a planet at a time.
Jason looked away for a moment, gathering himself. If I feel we have to act to restore stability and security, will you be standing with me? Will you stage a coup with me? Did I really say that? Niathal did pause, but it wasn't the taken-aback pause of someone shocked by an outrageous proposal. Just a moment of sizing up Jason Solo.
You might have the GAG behind you, Jason, but you need the fleet too, don't you? And the rest of the army.
Is that a yes?
It's an if things get worse. I put my allegiance to the GA before my allegiance to an individual.
I'm interested to see that the military will cross the line from carrying out the government's will into deciding policy.
In case you forget,
said Niathal softly,
the Office of Supreme Commander effectively combines the role of Defense Secretary and the Chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. I am a politician. I also happen to be the most senior military officer.
It's time we had a chat with Omos, then. Jason stood up and brushed down his black GAG fatigues with his hands. Just to be certain. For all we know, he might be meeting Gedgen to whip out a blaster himself and effect another Corellian regime change. Niathal followed him into the corridor that led to the Chief of State's suite. Elegant blue and gold marble and niche-studded walls with fine statues from across the galaxy. The doors to the Chief of State's suite slid open, and he walked into the quiet, thickly carpeted reception room with Niathal at his side. Not behind, not ahead, but exactly level with him. Omos was leaning over his aide's desk, talking in hushed tones.
I'm sorry to have kept you waiting, he said, looking up. Do come in.
Jason moved his chair so he wasn't forced to squint at Omos against the light from the window. So did Niathal. It was an eloquent, silent statement of who would have the upper hand, and they hadn't rehearsed it. Omos, a man finely attuned to the subtleties of body language and psychological advantage, radiated wariness in the Force. He knew he was dealing with a united front.
Who's first?
Niathal inclined her head politely.
I'll keep it brief,
she said.
We can't get involved in every little skirmish to keep obscure senators and tinpot heads of state in the Alliance. We're at overstretch. We couldn't maintain the Corellian blockade, and now we have the Bothans ramping up. Pick your battles, Chief of State. I can't fight them all.
Omos did his displacement act and poured himself a cup of caff from the jug on his desk. There was just one cup, and he didn't offer more.
If we fail to show support to Alliance member worlds, then we lose them, he said. This is basic numbers. We've been through all of this. If more secede, then we've lost. The issue of how we maintain a joint defense force for the Alliance, which is what started this, in case we forget, then becomes academic.
If we don't concentrate our forces on the worlds that present the most immediate and serious threat, then we'll be ground down a ship at a time, and we might not even be able to defend Coruscant if it comes to the worst.
You think it might come to that? Is this about Coruscant in the end?
Of course it is,
Nyathol said.
It always is. The Alliance and Coruscant are indivisible, and that's half the problem for all the other worlds.
Omos turned to Jason.
Your turn, Colonel.
I share the Admiral's fears about overstretch. Corellia is still the heart of this. I say we devote all our resources in the immediate term to an all-out assault on Corellia. Invasion, in fact. Destroy their industrial base and remove Gedgen and his cronies. The man's already had his predecessor killed and made an attempt on the Hapen Queen Mother. Jason paused a beat, because timing was everything. I have no doubt you will be next.
You have intelligence to suggest that?
Omos asked. Jason shook his head. No, and I don't need it, or help from the Force to work it out. It's how Gedgen does business.
If we launch that kind of assault on Corellia, it's something I should take to the Security Council. And even if they agree to it...
We're at war. You have all the legal powers to determine the conduct of the war with Admiral Nyathol, as you see fit.
Until it costs more credits,
said Omos.
And once we're conspicuously focused on Corellia... What are Bothui and Commonor going to do?
Omos had the perfect excuse now to admit to the meeting with Gedgen. He could have said that he was going to give peace talks one last try. He could have said anything to indicate that he was going to talk terms with a state that showed no signs of understanding the words common good, and whose quietly lethal leader could have scared a Hutt ganglord. And, Jason thought, any smart politician might have suspected that his intelligence service spied on him, just as they spied on all the other senators. A little game of words. Omos could have made the suggestion and watched Jason's reaction, brazening it out to test if his clandestine call had been picked up. But he didn't, and his future and his fate were sealed.
So where are we going with this?
Nyathol asked.
Same strategy? Keep dividing up the fleet until we have one ship per theater?
I think a full assault on Corellia is madness,
said Omos.
We might well have to consider it, but much later. In the meantime, my priority is to stop secessions from the Alliance from reaching the tipping point.
Jason placed his hands squarely on the arms of the Apakia wood chair and eased himself to his feet. For the record, I think this is a big mistake, sir, he said. And I would be happier if GAG could support our intelligence community in their efforts beyond Coruscant.
I note your views, Colonel Solo, and I'm grateful for your strategic input so far.
Jason didn't catch Nyathol's eye. He walked out, followed closely by her, and said nothing until they were back in her office. Well?
Not good,
she said. If he does a deal with Gedgen, we're not just back to square one. The Alliance is in a worse position than when it started.
And we'll be out of the game.
That's academic, because the game will be recurring wars.
Or Omos might end up with a vibroblade in his throat.
He's insane to meet Gedgen face to face without close protection anyway. He hasn't asked for it from us. He hasn't asked CSF either.
GA Intel?
No. We tap their comms, too.
You're a source of constant revelation, Jason Solo.
Are you in?
Say it.
Jason looked around the room, trying to look as if he was simply thinking, but suspicious that someone else might be doing to him what he did to them. Electronic eavesdropping. Was Nyathol setting him up? No. He was sure he could sense bugs in a room. There were none. You know what I'm proposing.
I don't, actually. Not in detail. Say it.
Regime change. We remove him from office long enough to get this war won, and then hand it back to Senator Casil when the situation is stable so that new elections can take place. Niathal made a little sputter that could have been laughter.
I get the removal. It's the gap in the middle between remove and elections that fascinates me.
We run the GA during the interim as a duumvirate. No dictatorship, joint control. Niathal indicated her uniform, and then reached out to jab a bony finger into the rank tab on his shoulder.
Military coup, that's what it's called. Let's not prevaricate.
Okay, I remove him and you take over alone.
I don't think so. Duumvirate sounds best to me.
I'll take care of Gedgen, by the way, he said. He's a massively destabilizing influence, and removing him will throw Corellia into disarray.
How will you take care of Omos?
I'll remove him by house arrest. I'll have someone there when Omos meets Gedgen. Jason checked his datapad. He needs only a day to do his business with Gedgen, no more. So my people have him under surveillance, ready to move. Then we have evidence to present to Casil.
And then you arrest him.
I was thinking I might arrest him at the same time you present the evidence to Casil. When we move, we have to move fast. No room to be outmaneuvered. Niathal let out a long breath. Jason waited.
I'll be ready to move on your signal. Make sure you keep me up to speed with all this, won't you?
It was done. Jason's takeover was in place. He had the GAG at his back, and Niathal would deliver the fleet as well as the army. With the right presentation of Omos selling out to the Corellians, it would be a very orderly coup. There was no need for unnecessary bloodshed. That was what this was all about. An end to violence, chaos, and instability. That was worth everything he was risking.
Safe House, Coruscant.
So you're going to do it before you achieve your full Sith powers, said Lumaya.
She lit the candles and closed the blinds. Jason needed to shut out the world and feel what was happening. He was running increasingly on a mundane agenda, the agenda of the lesser beings he worked with.
Why?
If I do it afterward, when might afterward be? Jason watched the flame shimmering and settled down cross-legged on the floor cushion. Omos is doing a deal with Gedgen. The deal excludes me, and Niathal, possibly in a rather terminal way.
Niathal is afraid of you, Jason, or at least wary.
Don't you think I know that? She'd be an idiot if she trusted anyone at this level of government.
You waste too much energy playing mundane games instead of using the Force.
I'll use it when I need to. Most of the time now, it's overkill.
Meditate, said Lumaya.
Jason stared through her for a moment, and then stared unblinking at the candle until he eventually closed his eyes. He opened one eye slowly, looking as if he might be about to make a joke. Lumaya didn't feel in a humorous mood. Actually, I called you for a reason, he said.
I know, but I'd like to approach this like Force users, not like some tedious little committee in the Senate.
It was time to remind him he still had one more step to take before he could begin to teach her anything.
Calm yourself and put the world to one side.
Jason shut his eyes again, and for once seemed to relax enough to allow a little of his state of mind to filter through the barrier that he now kept in place most of the time.
You don't need to play their games, Jason, she said softly. Even now, your powers put you far beyond their reach. Omos can't touch you, neither can Gedgen. When you achieve your destiny, they'll be less than irrelevant.
Powers or not, I can't control the galaxy on my own. I need to persuade, to carry people with me. The Force can't affect the minds of millions.
Jason, she said, I want you to take stock and feel. Stop overanalyzing. It won't reveal any truths to you. Just facts. Facts only show you what you want to see.
Jason opened his eyes again.
But it's so fleeting. The line between a crazy impulse and guidance from the Force is getting harder to draw. Because you think about it too much.
The impenetrable wall went up again. Lumaya felt it as he lapsed into silence. It's Ben, he said at last. It has to be Ben. Now she understood.
You're fond of the boy. Perhaps he's the child you don't have. This will be hard, and that's probably why it has to be him.
That's probably it, Jason said, and looked down at his clasped hands. And it's hard to kill someone who doesn't deserve it.
But you don't know how it will happen.
Exactly.
You can't see yourself taking a lightsaber to a 14-year-old boy.
Maybe it won't be so literal. I'm sending him to assassinate Durgedjian when he meets Omas to do his deal. It's a job that needs doing. It tests Ben's skills and commitment. It's far easier for a teenage boy to get past Gedjian's security, and perhaps it will put him in real mortal danger. Jason reached out to the low table nearby, leaning on one hand to stretch and pick up one of the candles in its transparent blue holder. Now is that a consequence of the task? Or is that why I'm sending him? Am I sending him to his death?
Let it play out, Lumaya said. Stop rationalizing and let it happen.
She stood up to take the candle from him. I need your help, he said. I need you to distract Mara for a while.
I'll let her find me. That should do the trick. Can you give me a possession of Ben's? Something that would prove to Mara that I could get at him easily, without being traceable to you.
I'll get you a pair of his boots. He keeps several pairs in his locker. Mara already suspects a GAG connection.
Surveillance Center, GAG Headquarters, Coruscant.
Captain Gearden loomed in the doorway, backlit by the light from the corridor.
Showtime,
he said.
Nyarthal's just been designated as acting chief of state as of midnight.
The troopers on duty in the listening post looked up. Ben detached the bead amplifier in his ear and tried to make sense of that news.
What's happened to Omas?
He's going to be out of the office for a day.
Oh, I thought...
He has to give a little notice to hand over the reins of state to Nyarthal when he's out of contact. You know, command codes, that kind of stuff. So we have a window for his trip to Vopter tomorrow.
What cover story has he given? Ben asked.
Private medical matter.
Yeah, saving his backside, said Zverk.
I think this is the opportunity you've been waiting for, Ben.
Gearden beckoned to him.
Come on, briefing room.
He turned to Zverk.
I want to know his itinerary to Vopter. He won't be taking us along, but he'll still need transport, a minder and a pilot. So let's keep an eye on the logistics.
Bet he takes an intel zombie or two with him for company.
Well, we're keeping an eye on them, too. So that'll help us triangulate, won't it? Get to it, trooper.
The captain strode off down the corridor, whistling. When they reached the briefing room, Shivu and Lakoff were already there, poring over a wall full of illuminated holodisplays. Lakoff, looking far from comfortable in his brand-new lieutenant's rank insignia, gave Ben a nervous grin.
Our source and coronet confirms that Gedjian's rescheduled all his engagements for tomorrow, said Shivu. It's on for sure.
Timetable?
No outbound timings, but he expects to be back in time for a meeting by 0800 the next day. They're just working out how we get you close enough to Gedjian, and that has to be after he's finished his meeting with Omas, because the boss wants the evidence of the meeting for the Security Council.
Revelation dawned. Ben had hoped he'd have had more preparation time, but this was it.
We're doing the hit at the same time as the meeting? Not when he's on the way back, or...
We might not get another chance to take a crack at Gedjian away from his home turf.
The cough beckoned to Ben and made him look inside a fabric holdall leaning against the wall.
Like it?
Ben couldn't work out what it was at first, but when he looked in the bag, it turned out to be a rifle with a folding stock. He unfolded it and snapped the stock into place, staring at it in numb realization.
It's a modified Carpaki 50,
Lakoff said, totally misreading Ben's reaction to the weapon.
Can't leave lightsaber marks all over Gedgen, can we?
Bit of a giveaway. You're now going to make a very fast acquaint of a ballistic sniper rifle. You know, projectiles.
If you're trying to get me close to Gedgen, why do I need a sniper weapon?
In case we can't. Come on, let's get in a few hours on the indoor range.
Bevin Vassour Farm, 10 kilometers outside Kildabe, Mandalore.
Goran Bevin looked up from the trench, a pitchfork in one hand and a muddy grin on his face. It was beginning to rain, and he was up to his ankles in animal dung, but it seemed to make him perfectly happy.
"And they said being active Mandalore wouldn't go to my head," he said, rubbing his nose on his sleeve. "So you came home fast, then?"
Fett kept his distance.
"Found what I was looking for. You didn't expect me back?"
"I did. Some of the clan chieftains didn't. You have a habit of wandering off for a few years at a time."
Bevin heaved himself out of the trench and wiped his palms on the seat of his pants. He looked very, very pleased with himself.
"If you'd been away any longer, I'd have called you. But since you're back, want to see something amazing?"
Fett wondered if now was a good time to tell Bevin the truth about his illness. The man had to know sooner or later.
"Okay. Amaze me."
Bevin beckoned and trudged through the mud toward the farm buildings.
"Mirta behaving herself?"
Bevin didn't look back over his shoulder.
"Well, at least she hasn't tried to kill you again. That's a good sign. Kids can be such a handful."
Fett felt the mud suck at his boots.
"She's a useful pair of fists in a fight."
"She'll produce wonderfully ferocious great-grandchildren for you, Bobica."
Bevin paused a few beats. Fett tried to take in the phrase, great-grandchildren, and it left him stranded.
"So whatever it was you went to do ended in a fight, did it?"
"Just had to ask questions emphatically."
"You gotta tell me about it?"
It seemed as good a time as any, and Fett didn't see the point of sugarcoating it.
"I'm terminally ill. 2 years, tops. 8-9 months if I carry on like this."
Bevin still didn't turn around. He walked on for a few more meters, and then stopped in his tracks, and finally faced Fett. He looked genuinely upset. Fett couldn't recall anyone being upset for him before, except his father. Lack of caring worked both ways.
"You're not gonna sit back and let it happen, are you, Bobica? We can do something, surely."
"I found a clone who survived."
"So they did get a little more out of Kosai than revenge and a few souvenirs, then?"
"There was no research data. Just the clone, Jang Skirata. He wouldn't give me a blood sample, but he says he's got good medical resources. I'll explain later."
Bevin turned around and started walking again in silence. The farm was a rambling collection of buildings scattered around a stone farmhouse with impressive dirtworks and defensive walls. At the back of the building, and connected to it by an underground tunnel, stood a workshop with a smithy. Fett could hear the rhythmic hammering of metal across the clearing. There was no smoke curling from the roof. Bevin walked down the steps cut into the hard-packed soil and leading down to the front door. It opened, and Dinua, his adopted daughter, stood with hands on hips.
"Boots,"
she said ominously, pointing at the clods of dung and mud. Two small children clung to her legs.
"You too, Mandalore. And you can take those coveralls off as well, Buir."
"Okay, okay."
Bevin, spy, fixer, veteran commando, was driven back by a resolute woman. But Dinua had fought and killed Yuuzhan Vong from the age of 14, so making a mess on her clean floor wasn't to be attempted rashly.
"We'll go the long way around."
They trampled around the perimeter of the farmhouse, following the sound of ringing metal. As the door to the workshop swung open, a blast of warm air registered on his sensors. The interior was bathed in a red glow. Sparks flew in arcing showers. A mountain of a man in a singlet, burn-scarred leather apron, and ear defenders was hammering a strip of red-hot metal. Every time he raised his arm, sweat flew from him and hissed into steam on the hot surfaces. He folded the strip with tongs as he hammered, layering the metal with a steady rhythm that said he was a master armorsmith. After a while, he realized Fett and Vavine were standing, watching. He gestured with an impatient jab of his finger to show he was going to finish working the metal before he'd stop to talk. Fett could see from the length and emerging form of the metal bar that he was making a Beskad, the traditional saber of the ancient Mandalorians. Vavine had one, an antique blade fashioned from Mandalore's unique iron, Beskar.
There.
Medrid Vassur cooled the rough form of saber in a tub of hissing liquid and turned it this way and that to check the line.
Now that's gonna be a thing of beauty. Marika, I haven't told him yet, said Vavine. Shall I blurt it out then? You're the metallurgist. Mondador, Madrid said stiffly. You're looking at a test forging from a new load of Beskar.
It took Fett a slow second to grasp the importance of what Medrid had said.
But the Empire strip mined Mandalore. They took all the iron.
They missed a bit. A big bit.
How? And how big?
This is a big planet with a tiny population, and even the Imperials didn't survey all of it. They stripped the shallow veins. This is a deeper load, and we'd never have found it if the Vongese hadn't left craters you could sink a small moon in. There's a crew a few hundred clicks north of Ansari, still doing test drills, but it looks like a big, big load that was exposed.
Beskar was the toughest metal known to science. Even lightsabers had trouble with it. There had been a time when every army in the galaxy wanted a supply. It was still the most valuable metal on the market, and there was a war raging around them.
I feel a new economic era coming on, said Fett.
Vavine winked.
Oya, Manda!
And it's not on anyone's land.
Fett realized the reason he'd never quite got a handle on what Mandalorian government actually meant was because it was so nebulous.
This is a resource for Mandalore as a whole.
If you say it is, then it is. That's the Mandalore's prerogative.
Okay, I say it is. Time to gather the chieftains and do a little forward planning.
Shab,
said Medrit, underwhelmed by the Mandalore's power to requisition resources.
You're sounding just like a proper head of state.
Fett would normally have found a family meal and a long explanation of the finer points of metallurgy worse than a spell in the Sarlacc. It was hard enough getting used to having a granddaughter without being besieged by Bavine's noisy, messy, demonstrative family. But that evening, he tolerated it.
It's not just the ore,
Medrit said, drawing an imaginary graph in midair with a Nuna drumstick.
It's the processing. Part of the strength of the metal is in what's added during smelting and how it's worked. What you saw was just a test bench.
Have we got the facilities to do that anymore?
Fett wasn't used to eating in front of anyone else. Dinua's son and daughter, Shalk and Brilla, 7 and 5, he estimated, stared at him, unimpressed across the table. The scrutiny of small children was unnerving.
Do we have a windfall we can't exploit?
On a small scale, we can do it, Bavine said. I've done a few rough calculations. If the load produces the yield we think it will, we're gonna need some help, from mining right through to processing. Mandal Motors could process some of it, if they're willing to shift resources from combat craft. But the rest, we need droids.
But what are you gonna do with it? Dinua
asked.
What?
Sell it for foreign currency, or use it to arm yourselves?
Dinua, orphaned on the battlefield like Fett, was a savagely smart woman. Bavine had adopted her the moment her mother was killed. But Fett found that ability, to turn strangers into family, that that central part of Mandalorian culture, was beyond him. Even Medrit, impatient, critical, short-tempered, had accepted the unexpected addition to their household without a murmur. Adoption was what Mandalorians did, and always had.
If he can do it, why can't I? With my own flesh and blood, too.
We do both.
Fett tried to stay on the subject.
Some manufacture goods for export, some for our own rearmament.
You'll find a lot of support for that, Bavine said. Satisfies both camps.
What else can I do with the time I have left to me, except leave Mandalore in decent shape?
If we've got it, someone will want to take it.
You think anyone's stupid enough to try invading like the Empire did?
Bavine said.
After we kick Vong's shibs like that?
Boba Weir's cussing, said Shulk gravely. Can I say shibs too? No, you can't.
Dinua clicked her teeth in annoyance.
Buir, please, not in front of the kids. Mandalore, how are you going to announce the find? Other than the old-fashioned Mondo way by showing up at the border with an invading army.
Do we have to announce it?
If we want foreign revenue.
We don't have a finance minister, but the job's yours.
I'm serious.
Commission a few staff artists and see who notices. Maybe this Mondo nationalist guy, Kadika, has a point. And we don't have to be on one side or the other. There's a third side, as Gorin says.
It was only courtesy to address him by his first name in his own house. Fett had so little non-hostile interaction with anyone that basic etiquette felt like a minefield.
Our own.
I can make sure the Orotise notice, said Bavine. But maybe a surprise is better.
What kind of surprise?
The kind that makes you look up and run for a bomb shelter, Bavine said. With a Mondal Motors logo on the fuselage.
We've got no territorial ambitions beyond the sector. We've got at least a dozen planets here to worry about.
I know. But take a planet in post-war recovery, an ongoing civil war, and a new find of Beskar. And we might have visitors. If not armed, then at least trying to do deals.
Whatever. I don't lose sleep over what?
Bavine filled the gap.
Aruatise.
Aruatise, think of us. I'll talk to Yumaget in the morning. See what Mandal Motors can commit.
GAG Headquarter Locker Rooms, Coruscant, 2100 hours.
Shivu took a long look at Ben and handed him a small container. It was filled with a dark brown fluid.
You look deadbeat, said Shivu. But before you turn in for the night, there's a few loose ends to tie up.
Ben, slumped on a bench with his back resting on his locker door, was ready to drop. He had to be up at 0300 to prep for the flight to Vulptor, and he still didn't know his final destination or the location for the hit. That wasn't unusual, apparently. It was just as well. He was used to improvising.
I'm scoring 97%, sir.
Shivu sounded as if he'd stifled a laugh. He exuded a sense of pity. It's hard to know what to say.
I'm ready. Really, I am.
I meant that it's amazing that we can pretty well train a sniper in a day. If he's a Jedi, of course.
Shivu put the bottle in Ben's hand.
You're being inserted ahead of time with Lakoff, and I'll be shadowing Omas's flight.
Larvi on Vulptor, at Charby City Spaceport, because he's meeting Gedgen in one of the conference rooms there that they hire out for business meetings by the hour. Personally, I think GA Intel is insane to let him do that. No sterile area, no screening, no security except for the two guys with him for close protection. But it's anonymous. There's no advance booking to trace. Charby is a slum, and we can stroll in.
Ben held the bottle up to the light.
So, what's this?
Hair dye. Most species tend to recall red-headed humans a bit too well. You're still a genetic minority. And Omas knows you well enough to look twice if he spots you.
Tell me I don't have to wear makeup to cover my freckles.
Ben's mind was a couple hours ahead, thinking of a few hours' sleep he could get on the flight. He could study the layout of the spaceport on his datapad. It was all going to go fine, he told himself.
So, the second vessel's for backup in case he diverts?
Partly. And partly so we have something incriminating to abandon on Volta. Read the label, dye your hair, and report to the landing strip at 22:30. I'll see you there. Shibu started to walk away. Ben jumped to his feet.
Sir, what's going to be incriminating?
The captain looked at Ben with that mix of sadness and patience that Ben had seen on his dad's face too often.
I think anyone would believe Corellians had neutralized Gedgen, given the right vessel abandoned at the port. You know, Corellian registered, Corellian trace for forensics. You can do a Corellian accent, can't you? If push comes to shove, and you need to speak, that is. There have to be plenty of Corellians with a grudge against him, knowing their politics.
Ben thought of Uncle Han's accent, or what was left of it. He sounded more Coruscant-y these days.
Can do. But how do we know we won't fall over real Corellians trying to stop Gedgen doing a deal with the enemy?
That, said Shibu, would be unbelievably hilarious for all the wrong reasons. Assuming he has a deal to put on the table anyway.
I'm going to kill someone. And in 24 hours, I'll be back here as if nothing's happened. Any reason why I can't take my vibroblade?
Ben fished it from his pocket and held it out to Shibu.
My mom gave it to me and, well, you know.
You can take whatever works for you, as long as you don't leave or carry evidence that links the hit to us.
Shibu examined the blade.
Yeah, I understand.
He pulled down the neck of his shirt a little to reveal a gold chain.
No ID, of course, but my girlfriend gave it to me, and I never go on patrol without it.
It helped to know everyone got edgy before a mission and needed a little reminder of their loved ones. Shibu got halfway to the doors before he turned around and seemed to be working up to saying something.
I realize your father might find it hard to accept what you do, Ben,
but I'm proud of you, he said. Still, if I had a son, I wouldn't be letting him do this kind of thing until he was an adult. It's not as if we haven't got enough trained men to do it. But, well, Colonel Solo has his reasons, I'm sure.
Ben sat thinking over that statement for a while, and realized that Shibu had said father, not parents. Maybe he thought that his mother would understand a job like this.
Ben stood in the refresher with the dye worked into lather on his head, and caught sight of himself in a mirror. He felt ridiculous. The foam looked mauve, and he wondered if something had gone horribly wrong. When he rinsed it off, though, his hair was brown, just brown, and he was looking at a stranger. Good. He needed to be someone else, for all kinds of reasons.
The Skywalker's apartment, Coruscant.
Luke woke in a heart-pounding panic and reached out toward a hooded shape at the foot of the bed, knowing he was dreaming, but unable to stop himself from reacting to the specter that dissolved as he became fully awake. He hadn't had the dream of the menacing figure in the hooded cloak for a while. Now it was back. It was 4 in the morning, and Mara still hadn't come home. Luke reached for his lightsaber, which he'd been keeping on the nightstand lately, and made a cautious inspection of all the rooms. He couldn't sense flesh and blood anywhere, but he could detect something. The presence was so close now that he could almost feel breath on the back of his neck. And then he sensed amusement. The presence, now at the door to the apartment, he was sure, was like a cloud of billowing smoke in his mind. Lumaya. Lumaya! Luke rushed to the front doors, at the same time concentrating hard on using the Force to jam the two sets of doors in the corridor outside that stood between the apartment and the lifts. The doors parted with a gasp of air, and Luke sprang into the corridor with his lightsaber raised. One set of doors was wedged open with something, trying repeatedly to close, and making little mechanical groans each time the inner edges hit the obstruction and bounced back a few centimeters. There was no sign of Lumaya, but she'd been here seconds before. Luke could almost taste her on the air. Frustrated and furious, he strode down the corridor to see what had jammed the doors apart. It was a pair of black boots. Army boots, with segmented Durasteel plates around the ankle. The kind that Ben wore. He parted the doors with a Force push and squatted to recover the boots. They were Ben's. He went back into the apartment to grab his jacket, opening his comlink to Jason as he went. He didn't care what time it was. Jason answered immediately.
It seemed he didn't sleep much either.
"Where's Ben?" Luke demanded.
"Asleep, Luke."
Jason had that calm, mock-soothing tone that did anything but soothe him. Patronizing little jerk.
"Is there a problem?"
"Have you had any intruders at GAGHQ tonight?"
Jason gave a quiet little laugh.
"We're the ones who do forced entry, Luke."
"Someone's left Ben's boots here as a calling card."
"I don't understand. Did he leave them behind?"
"He doesn't keep any of his uniform at our place. It's Lumaya. She's taunting me, showing me she can get at Ben any time she pleases."
Jason was silent. Luke waited.
"I can't give you an explanation for that. I really can't,"
Jason said eventually.
"Well, Lumaya's jerking my chain, as she probably was at Galater, too." "Stupid, stupid, stupid. How could I ever have been fooled like that? And she has someone inside your organization, so I suggest you get that sorted out fast."
"We've had one investigation already and found nothing. We'll have another if that makes you happier."
Jason's voice sounded both offended and irritated, but Luke couldn't even take that at face value any longer.
"But I can assure you Ben is safe. He's even got pretty good protection right next to him. Lieutenant Lakoff."
"Nice to see that guy get promoted. He strikes me as being very loyal to you."
"As his grandfather was to Vader, Luke. You can't buy loyalty like that. Ben's in good hands. Let's talk again in the morning."
Luke shut the link dead. No, the morning wouldn't do. And there was no point talking to Jason, who was clearly trussed and tied as far as Lumaya's influence was concerned. She was right under his nose. So much for what he'd learned in his 5-year sabbatical from his arcane force techniques. Luke jogged to the landing pad and tore off in the speeder, maybe a little faster than was safe. He opened the comlink.
"Mara, we have a problem. Lumaya."
"I'm with Jaina, sweetheart. Do you want me to..."
"She's been outside our apartment. Stay where you are. I'll be there in a few minutes."
"When there's a trail going cold?"
"Or a diversion."
"Or a trail she wants you to think is a diversion."
Yes. Mara and Lumaya both had that layer upon layer way of thinking, just as Palpatine had taught them. "I know what she wants," he said, and shut the link.
GA Starfighter Command, Coruscant.
"You know, this always works on the crime holovids."
Mara added another illuminated marker to the holochart of the galaxy and stepped back to see if a pattern of Lumaya's movements emerged. It was a big galaxy, and Lumaya seemed to cover a lot of space, which now included Mara's own front doors.
"Might as well use the time productively."
Jaina leaned over the desk and tapped in more coordinates. Now that she was a civilian again, she was here in her capacity as a Jedi, working for Luke Skywalker and the Council. But she slipped back into fleet ways fast.
"So let's add in Alima's known whereabouts."
"Well, there's no pattern there, either. Do you think it's a case of Alima stalking Lumaya? Looking for scraps from her table? Why do those two seem to hang out together?"
"They both need a lot of spare parts."
Mara stifled a laugh. "That's not nice, Jaina."
"Seriously, they haven't got enough functioning parts to make one decent humanoid between them."
"They're both good at hiding, whether by disguising their presence or erasing the memory of being seen." Mara was feeling around her in the Force, just waiting for Lumaya to spring from nowhere. She could sense her, but not near. Lumaya's broken her cover, and she's not stupid, so she wants to be seen. Jaina kept checking the chrono on the wall, and then looking at her own timepiece.
"Did you see Jason?"
"Yes."
"And?"
"You want the truth, Jaina?"
"Don't I always?"
Lumaya's bending him somehow. "Okay, no need to tell me I was the last person to notice that."
"I wasn't going to. Did you mention that?"
"Yes. I thought it was time someone dropped a hint that we noticed our Jason had turned into a monster." Mara was getting angry, and her honest inner voice told her that the only person who deserved that anger was herself, for defending Jason while the fact that things were going disastrously wrong was staring her in the face. But Mara was human and scared for Ben, and it boiled over into Jaina.
"Forgive me for asking, but being his twin, have you never had this out with him?" I tried. He responded with a court-martial charge, remember? I can't help thinking that you might have tried slugging him. Suddenly he's my responsibility? I'm the one who said he was going dark way back. Okay, I'm sorry. Mara put her hands up in mock submission.
Change of plan, said Luke, stepping out of the turbo lift with his hair disheveled and a bag in one hand. I'm going after Lumaya. Enough.
No, you're not, Mara said. You're too close to this. She's baiting you.
Luke dumped the bag on the desk, disrupting the holochart. Jaina stepped back.
Ben's boots, said Luke. And the point is?
Deposited at our apartment by Lumaya. Mara put her hand on the boots and felt the remnants of dark energy. Now she was mad. Cold, clear, icy mad.
She's been into GAG headquarters, or Jason's apartment. I don't know which idea I like less.
I need to settle this with her.
It is, as some admiral once said, a trap.
For her, biting off more than she can chew.
Jaina looked at them both, still feeling a little wounded. Uncle Luke, I'll stick my nose in here and say it's better if we go after Lumaya now, because she's clearly playing a game, and I've never seen you angry like this before.
Luke, the question to ask yourself is this, Mara said, pulling on her jacket and checking her personal weapons.
What will you do when you catch her?
Luke swallowed hard. I know what I have to do.
And what was that conversation we had the other day about being fit for role? Me, trained killer. You, honest guardian of right? Lightsaber, vibroblades, holdout blaster, flechette launcher, and the last of my transponders. Check. Here's the plan. You keep an eye on Jason while I go after her.
I'm coming too, Jaina said. I'd hate to miss Alima if she shows up.
Mara tapped her forefinger to her brow in a mock salute and walked off with Jaina. When she got in the turbo lift, she checked her data pad to see where Ben's transponder had gotten to.
If you've left that blade in your locker, Ben.
A little earlier, it had shown up on the data pad's small screen as a static blip in Galactic City, in GAG headquarters. Now, it didn't. Mara never panicked, but she reserved the right to professional apprehension. She switched the scale of the chart.
What's wrong?
Jaina asked.
Nothing. Nothing at all.
Mara flicked through ever larger scales of the screen until she picked up the transponder blip again, and the coordinates didn't make sense. Ben appeared to be on Vulptor.
What takes you there, Ben? Vulptor's not in the war.
Mandal Motors Research Wing, Keldabe, Mandalore.
What do you think, then, Fett?
Jir Yamaget was the kind of man who probably had to be anesthetized to get him into a business suit. He stood with his arms folded, gazing rapt at an airframe that Fett hadn't seen before, an incongruously scruffy and disturbingly young man in dark green coveralls and partial armor.
Prototype?
Yamaget nodded.
Started life as a Kirgalar. Up to 3 crew, or 2 with extra payload. Atmosphere capable, configurable for anything from planet pounding to hunter-killer roles. And fast. Now tell me it's not gorgeous.
Research wing was a flattering term for the collection of scruffy sheds and hangars. But the ramshackle appearance of the exterior belied the technology within. Mondal Motors had struggled to get back on its feet under a galactic alliance that wasn't handing out reconstruction grants to Mandalore. Now it had an edge it could exploit.
How fast?
Asked Fett. Yamaget probably didn't look at his wife and kids with as much adoration as he was lavishing on the assault fighter.
0.4 hyperdrive, the ultimate shock weapon.
And you never offered me the chance to purchase?
Fett had modified Slave 1 to a 0.7.
That beats an X-Wing.
Unfinished prototype.
It was about 15 meters nose to tail, with an 8-meter span. A faceted charcoal gray wedge of a ship that had none of the insectoid lines of the Star Viper. Fett walked around it, noting empty racks and housings, and took a guess that it would pack 4 laser cannons and maybe a couple of other weapons. The tail ended in a flat section, with grills and vents that looked like the ports on a data pad. The skin was totally plain,
and angled surfaces unbroken except for the Mythosaur logo, picked out in a lighter gray on the side hatches.
So it's fast and pretty.
Deflective stealth hull, cooled vents, scanner absorbent coating,